Welcome to Office Hours with Adam Peterson, where I talk to business owners, employees, entrepreneurs and experts to find answers to those day-to-day questions about life and work in Luxembourg. If you have questions you'd like answered, let me know at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn. But for now, on to today's show. On Office Hours this week, I will dive straight into the introductions. I'll be interviewing an emergency response operations manager, a chief technology officer, a chief executive officer, and a private investigator. Now, I know what you're thinking. There are only four microphones in the studio. Where are all the people going to sit? But don't worry, all of these roles are listed in the experience of just one person. Probably the most eclectic LinkedIn profile I've ever read. So this week, it is another tale from the top. In addition to doing the roles above, Sam Staincliffe is the co-founder and CEO of Uplift 360.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Good. According to his website, Uplift 360 develops chemical-based regeneration technologies to recover and reuse advanced materials. Now, I've listed some of your jobs, and being a CEO of a chemical regeneration company, I was looking forward to seeing a fellow chemist, but I found a master's in humanistic studies. So let me start off with a simple question. Like, what do you describe yourself as?
I describe myself very much as a founder first. So having built a startup with my co-founder, Jamie, over the last 5 years, we have between us pretty much done every job imaginable within a company. And so founder seems to be a capture-all title for literally everything from making sure we have tea to negotiating defense contracts.
Yeah, the tea is always important. There's an alleged reason that the workforce in Alaska unionized was because they took away the ice cream machine. Never forget those important things.
So the first piece of equipment we bought in Luxembourg was a coffee machine.
Brilliant.
We understand exactly the priorities.
The most important thing. So let's go even earlier than that. So tell me a bit about early Sam. Where did you grow up? Were you entrepreneurial? Were you finding things when you were a child?
I wouldn't describe myself that way in any way, shape or form. I don't think young me would have ever thought about entrepreneurship or startup. It wasn't even a career trajectory I'd even considered. I very much loved science. I loved English literature. I loved history, archaeology. I was just broad, very interested in just exploring the world.
And you grew up in England?
Originally, I was born in the States, but to British parents. So spent a few years of my life over in America, came back over to the UK, and then have been kind of traveling around the world from about the age of 18.
Yeah, so where did you grow up in the UK?
So in the Midlands.
In my hometown.
You've mentioned Birmingham, yep. Right? So I was over in a place called Burton-on-Trent.
Oh, yeah. Where the beer comes from.
Exactly. Bass Brewery. And Marmite, critically.
Yes. Marmite, the scrapings from the bottom of a beer barrel. And then university.
So I went to University of Kent and then also Penn State.
Humanistic studies. What is humanistic studies?
A very broad academic exploration. So I had the opportunity whilst at university to do multiple courses, broadly covering most of the humanities. So politics, history, drama and theatre studies, archaeology, English literature, language, and together combined basically becomes the humanities.
And the decision to go over to Penn State?
I love sport. Ah. in all ways, all things. My dad got me hooked on American football pretty young.
Okay.
And obviously being born in America, I wanted the chance to be able to study over there and kind of explore a little bit more of, you know, where I was brought up.
And did you play?
So I made rugby.
Really?
Yeah, where I started getting all my injuries.
Okay.
From a young age. So I did netball, hockey, rugby, terrible at pretty much everything, but very enthusiastic.
Okay. So you went back to Penn State. You didn't think about staying in America then and becoming president?
Now I'm definitely considering whether or not that was a right choice, but no, it didn't cross my mind as a career trajectory.
But maybe something in the future. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. Tell me about your world of work then. So where was your first job and how do you get from humanistic studies to being the CEO of Uplift 360?
So the US Air Force was basically fundamental to my entire career trajectory. So I graduated 2009, so just after kind of like major economic crashes around the world. There wasn't a lot of opportunities to be able to get into the departments I wanted to get into, which was government, defense, foreign affairs, anything within that sphere. I wanted to have a career where I felt like I could have a true impact on the world. So I was basically looking for any route in in existence. And the US Air Force was recruiting for civilians to join basically departments as kind of glorified secretaries, so administrators. And I took any opportunity I could get to get my foot in the door.
Okay. And are you American then? You have an American passport?
Yeah, that definitely helped be able to access the career path.
So you started in the US Air Force?
As a civilian. I know a lot of people who've worn the uniform. It's very important to distinguish my career from theirs. They put themselves directly in the line of fire. I stand behind them. Okay. So I know that they are the true heroes.
And how long did you spend doing that?
I was working in the US Air Force for, I think, just under 2 years. So as I said, I kind of went in as an administrator, which I was truly the world's worst administrator in existence. I don't think it took anyone very long to realize that that was not an area of expertise that I should explore and keep working in.
So what was the skill you were missing though to do that? Why weren't you a great administrator?
I think I don't have a true attention to detail. I'm not someone that is drawn in by making sure that everything is alphabetized or that everything has its place and that everyone can coordinate something like, you know, perfectly and everything is well structured.
So you had a messy bedroom when you were growing up.
Is yeah. That kind of a... I mean, my husband would suggest that hasn't changed in the last 30 years. It's not a skill set or area that I'm particularly strong in.
Did you get to fly in a jet when you were there?
I got to fly in various aircraft in my career, which has been great fun. A jet is one thing that I have never managed to actually fly in. I got to sit in various fast jets, but I've never been taken up in them.
Not the world's greatest administrator, the US Air Force. Then what was next?
So the time I joined the US Air Force, they were on a 50% manning.
They had 100 posts and only 50 of them were filled. So they had loads of gaps.
They had huge amounts of gaps, massive amounts of gaps. And I was working with the US Air Force at the time of Libya. And I was working in the operations air refueling section, the UFS was on the European side. And I was supporting a meeting one day and multiple phones started ringing and someone basically grabbed two of the phones and there was no one else left in the room with the other phone still ringing. So I just was like, I'll get that one.
Okay.
Grabbed the phone and it was someone basically asking for some support in relation to an air refueling operation being able to take off.
Yeah. So this is all around the Arab Spring kind of time with the fall of Gaddafi. Is that one we're talking about?
So yeah, it's the kind of like 2009 to 2011 period of activity.
So you grabbed the phone, someone was stressed the other side, and then were you good under pressure? What happened?
I basically was like, okay, let me go see what I can do to try and find a solution to the problem you have. So I walked around the office, I spoke to various people, I got sent in various directions, took down the information, transferred it back to the person who needed it, found a person who could actually action something and was able basically to deliver a solution to the person at the other end of the phone. From that point on, basically, I stopped being the administrator or the secretary and I basically started supporting operation activity.
So that's the operations, emergency response operations manager type role you were doing?
I was supporting anything and everything that was needed. So that was sometimes, how do we ensure that the runway is cleared and that we can take off when we need to be able to take off, to how do we enable governmental engagement to ensure that we could use someone else's airspace.
So a bit of everything. So then roll me through the next couple of positions then, sir.
Yes. So I was then...
I'm really interested in the private investigator in Las Vegas.
Yeah,
that's the bit I'm interested in.
that does seem to be a bit that most people seem to be drawn to, as was I, clearly. So the UK Ministry of Defence then offered me an opportunity to come and join them through a fast track programme, which basically was like a concept of being able to go through multiple kind of areas to become a generalist and then become more kind of like senior leadership in the UK Ministry of Defence. I did one tour. And what was known as the out of office, basically you're the support function to a senior military leader.
So you're like their chief of staff, their kind of right hand person.
I was way
too
junior for that. So this was a very senior military leader, a 4-star military leader. So his out of office had multiple people in it. So I was just one of the cogs in that team. But obviously you're privy to a huge amount of information, opportunities, and being able to problem solve on an hourly, daily basis. So I worked in that team for a while, and then had the opportunity to then join a transition team working on intelligence, cybersecurity, and change development for a whole new division of the UK Ministry of Defence, known as Joint Forces Command. And then out of that, I was able to join the operations team at the Permanent Joint Headquarters, where basically I was like, I found my home.
Yeah. In this role, obviously you need to deal with confidential information, not share information when people necessarily ask for it. And you dodged the question I asked about the private investigator then. So where does that fit in the story? Tell me about that.
So I'm working in the operations area of defence, absolutely loving it. I was one of the Afghanistan desk officers, and my husband is in the military. So I've run this career path alongside someone who's also serving in the armed forces. And he has the opportunity to go and be stationed out in Las Vegas. I request a sabbatical from UK Ministry of Defence on the premise that if anything happens or they need anything from me in operational capacity, I can always come back as required. We'll come to that, thinking that will never happen. And so I moved to Las Vegas with my husband for an opportunity to just kind of explore that part of the world. And because of some of the work I've been doing, I was then able to explore roles in kind of contract intelligence, both on the private and governmental side. But to do that, you had to be a licensed private investigator.
Licensed PI, like Magnum PI.
A licensed private investigator. And I was approached by a group of ex-military intelligence officers who had set up their own company and asked whether or not I would be willing to come and train with them.
Good fun.
I mean, naivety, I think, was my only strength, because I hadn't realised how much danger I was in how often.
Really?
Yes. As a private investigator, apart from obviously having the requirement to have a licence, you can get involved in lots of stuff. So I did bounty hunting. I did like...
Bounty like Boba Fett?
like literally like helping people and on my own track down criminals, and then the reward would then be put into the company.
If only that was the point of this conversation, we could spend another half hour on this topic, I'm sure. But you hinted at it, I think, that did this get caught short then? Did you get called back to the MOD?
Yes. What happened? Activity kicked off in the Middle East with ISIS, and an opportunity came up for me to deploy to the Middle East on ship, basically to support operations from a command and control function in case things became any worse.
So you were stationed on a vessel in the Arabian Gulf?
Yeah, stationed on the vessel in various locations, 6 months.
So I'm not going to dig into too much of that detail. So this, Rolf, how did you get from there then to finding Uplift 360?
Yes, so both me and my co-founder, because of our kind of career history in defence, we've both seen firsthand what happens when our supply chains are broken or disrupted.
So you work together in the Ministry of Defence?
No. So my co-founder was a specialist in intelligence, but also kind of worked on multiple different programmes across defence. We actually believe we probably crossed over multiple times, but have no tangible recollection of ever doing so. But my co-founder and my husband were stationed on the same squadron, just at different times. So actually my co-founder and husband had a really good relationship before I met him. But his world, so he'd done kind of Middle East, Afghanistan activities, but he'd also done a huge amount on kind of like West Africa. After being in the Air Force for 22 years, he then joined the United Nations. So he was doing a lot of work on kind of humanitarian assistance in Western Africa. So he had seen kind of very much the supply chains, the level of waste that is created and where that waste ends up. And a huge amount of it is in Western Africa. Equally, I'd seen kind of the operational impacts of what happens when we can't access our equipment as quickly as we need it. And then also what happens to our equipment when it reaches the end of its life.
So how did you then get to form this company? So you got to know of each other through your husband. How did the company come about?
So it came about because both Jamie and I had a shared understanding of the problem. So the problem being, we need critical materials in Europe. They are fundamental to literally every aspect of our infrastructure, from defence, security, to transportation, to energy. And we don't have ownership of pretty much any of them in Europe. Like, we're not sitting on fossil fuel deposits. We don't have mines. So we are very, very reliant on multiple other state actors globally, to which we don't control our own destiny. So we could see that problem deeply. And because we had seen how our materials were treated at end of life, especially on an operational environment, in terms of, you know, we either burned them or buried them, That was the outcome for pretty much anything that contained a advanced material. We saw the opportunity to say, well, what happens if we could develop frontier technology to extract out material from waste and put it back into the high-value supply chain so that we could create our own material supply in Europe?
So I can picture this as a conversation over a beer. But then how does it get from this conversation of, oh, you know, we should do this, we should do that, to a company appearing? Tell me, I'm trying to understand that step.
It was pretty rapid, actually. So I had been working on another company, the idea of which was not successful in any way, shape or form. Obviously, my husband had been hearing me talk about this idea and the development of it, you know, over months. And I'd said, jokingly, if I was developing this idea in defence, I would have a lot more success.
Okay.
Because that's my network, that's the world that I know. And my husband had said, if you're looking at kind of like defence and innovation, a strategic mind, there's this guy called Jamie. He is brilliant. He's running hackathons, he's doing incredible stuff. He was actually out in the US. He was like, let me put you in contact. So Jamie and I had a couple of online calls and talked through basically some of the ideas that I've been having, some ideas he was having. And I think within 3 weeks, we had gone from this is really interesting to we want to build something.
And that's where the birth of Uplift 360 came from then.
Yes.
So let's move to a break. And then when we get back, we'll find a bit more about Uplift 360 and we'll get to see, find out what advice you have for people as well. February 6th, 2026, Bristol, United Kingdom and Luxembourg. Uplift 360, advanced material startup transforming how aerospace, defence and industrial sectors recover and reuse high-value composite waste, announced today the successful close of its €7.4 million seed funding round. A LinkedIn post capturing that news and a photo of today's guest with the British ambassador brought Uplift 360 to my attention. So welcome back to Office Hours. In part one, we heard about the career of Sam Staincliffe up to the point of being Uplift 360's CEO. And in part two, I want to find a bit more about the company, ask the chewier questions and get some lessons from Sam. So start off with them, a Bristol Luxembourg company. What's the benefit of Luxembourg? Is it a Brexit workaround? Why Luxembourg?
Luxembourg is our strategic home. There is no government globally that is as forward-thinking as Luxembourg is in relation to defence circular economy for strategic materials.
Defence circular economy. So that means circular economy being no waste, nothing going to landfill, recycling on steroids.
Effectively, recycling is a component of the circular economy. So circular economy is, yeah, very much about the idea of designing systems so that there is no waste. The idea being that you can be self-sufficient from a company standpoint, that's a very strong economic argument. From a European defence standpoint, that's about resiliency.
So what's the government doing that's different to, let's say, the UK government? When you said Luxembourg's the best government in this respect.
They're putting their money where their mouth is. So the Luxembourgish government have actually been exploring the circular economy, I think, for years. I recently discovered from a conversation with the European Investment Bank that the Luxembourgish Ministry of Economy started exploring circular economy from a governmental policy standpoint early 2010s. And then they started looking at how they integrate that into defence, I think in kind of like 2019, where they started looking at how they could fund the first European Defence Agency Circular Economic Forum. So that came from Luxembourg. So Luxembourg was like, we see an opportunity here. We care deeply about this topic. We recognise its importance in defence and we're going to put money in so that European defence starts to look at it.
So they arrange a forum and then they give people, what, subsidies to move here and set up business here or?
No, not at all. So what they were trying to do, and I won't speak for the government, but I can say in terms of what it came across from us in terms of their approach was to be able to initiate the conversation so that technology started to be focused in defence that was already operating in the circular economy. How multiple European governments, so what they did by funding this forum within the European Defence Agency is they got multiple players from across Europe, companies like Kongsberg, Saab, Rheinmetall, like, you know, Ministries of Defence from the Netherlands to France to Germany, to get involved in a conversation alongside their academic institutions and their private companies to say how circular economy could be used in defence, what is its importance, what technologies need to be developed here. Now, if you think about that, the idea of Defence Department's talking about circular economy is quite novel a concept in itself.
Yeah, because you sort of think of bombs like blowing stuff up and you can't really recycle those sorts of things, or can you?
Future would suggest potentially you can.
Okay.
but for the moment, that's still quite a leap. But the key aspect that they were thinking about was how to create a resilient Europe. So right now we have removed our control of materials. So the circular economy is a potentially very elegant solution to that problem, because we are sitting on tons and tons of waste that we can then turn into our future feedstock.
So before we have Uplift 360 doing all the good stuff it's going to do, where are we currently getting our materials from that are being used? And I think we're talking about composite materials, so like rotors for helicopters, materials for drones. Those the sorts of things we're talking about?
Yeah, so pretty much there isn't a defence capability, I don't think, being built today that doesn't have a composite component in it. And the kind of majority of drone technology is like 80% composite. That's things like carbon fibre and glues. So they are intrinsic to everything that we do from a defence capability, but equally as intrinsic to a wind turbine blade for our energy infrastructure, which clearly is also about our resiliency and our strength in Europe. And this isn't just about purely the warfighter capability, which clearly is a key aspect for what we care about, but there's also the critical industries. So everything that we need to keep functioning and keep growing in Europe.
And but who are the countries we are currently reliant on for the...
So the majority of the composites that we use in Europe, we're importing from places like China, Japan, America, various countries in Asia outside of that. We have some of our own native composite capability in Europe, but a lot of those native composite manufacturing in Europe is actually owned by Japanese companies or US companies.
So some are friends and allies, but often different parts of the world. And how do we keep it local so we can avoid supply chain disruptions like COVID, such as the issues that we have at the moment, Suez Canal gets blocked, all those sorts of things?
Well, it's that, and also it's where the material itself comes from that makes that product. So if you think about something like a Kevlar, that's a plastic. That plastic is made from petrochemical. Yes, let's say we're getting our supply of Kevlar from the US, or we're getting our supply of Tuaron, which is the Tejin equivalent, from the Netherlands. But the petrochemical that we need to make that, where is that coming from?
Yeah.
And that could be, you know, in terms of supply chains, that could be coming from Russia, that could be coming from the Middle East, that could be coming from the US. Like the fossil fuel supply chain that's supplying that material production is far more expansive, but also far more congested.
Yeah.
So the moment that there is a crisis like we're experiencing right now with fossil fuel prices, then the cost of and the access to our critical materials becomes far more at risk.
But what I'm hearing is that you're in the defense sector at the moment, I think in part because that's where your network is, and in part because there's funding available for that. But Uplift 360 wouldn't limit itself in the future. I hear you talking about wind turbines, more civilian use. The idea is to grow it into all these different non-defense related markets as well. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We are, I think, the perfect example of what a dual use company looks like. So someone that can operate in and support defense, and someone that can easily support civilian sectors as well. You know, composite usage for civilian aircraft is huge in terms of both the demand and the market. So, you know, we're definitely not limited by which industries we can support. We very much feel like we have a moral obligation to support defence in Europe. And so we want to ensure that critical industry is supported first, because that's what we need right now. And then everything that comes from that afterwards, absolutely want to support multiple other sectors.
Where do you spend your time then? So, and what do you have across in Bristol and over here in Luxembourg?
I'm based in Luxembourg. That's where our headquarters are. And that's also where one of our research divisions and function areas is. So we have a technology which is focused entirely on the aramid material world. So that's otherwise known as Kevlar. Yeah. That entire technology development program is based in Luxembourg. So we have a research facility here. We're hoping to build out significantly more of that team and then a pilot scale process all in Luxembourg. And then we have another team which is based in Bristol, which is a subsidiary company that is focusing on our carbon fibre production.
And down in Esch?
Yeah. So we're based at the House of Biohealth in Esch and working closely with the Luxembourg Institute of Science and Technology, one of our key partners.
Great. So we know a lot more now about Uplift 360. Now, just before we draw to a close, I want to just get some more questions about you and your advice for people. So you're a woman in STEM, but without a STEM degree. Any advice for people who want to get involved in science, technology, engineering and maths and where it kind of fits within the economy?
I believe genuinely that people shouldn't be limited in where they go with their careers based on their degrees. I think a degree is basically just a moment in time that shows that you're capable of learning. Right. So if you're interested in STEM subjects and you have a humanities degree, who says that you can't work in STEM? If it genuinely interests you and you feel that you can add value to those industries, then you should be absolutely pushing to go and access those environments. I think you know, go where your interests lie. I don't have a chemistry degree. I don't have an engineering degree, but I'm deeply interested in advanced material science.
Yeah.
And I'm incredibly proud of working with phenomenal scientists in this environment and seeing them grow and develop and produce frontier technology.
And how did you... that decision with Jamie, your co-founder, how did you decide who became COO and who became CEO? Was that a game of rock, paper, scissors, stone? How did you do it?
So it's actually evolved over time. So Jamie was originally the chief exec of the company and I was the chief technology officer. I am always deeply interested in the science and the technology. Again, don't be limited by your degree. Just because you don't have a degree doesn't mean you can't run and develop scientific programs. And then as the company evolved and was shaped more in Luxembourg and we wanted to expand more in Europe, it made absolute sense for me to take over the chief exec role and to establish the company headquarters and our strategic development here.
Okay, and he's based in Bristol or here as well?
So he splits his time between both.
Make him do the travel.
I mean, I also spend my time accessing both, going back and forth to both both countries, each equally important.
So the one question I like to ask people is, so you've made it to CEO, the top of a company that you've founded. How much is that down to your talent, your hard work, and your luck?
I think a significant portion of it is luck. Like, there is definitely something to be said about being in the right rooms, talking to the right people, seeing the opportunities. But then on top of that, you've got to be able to act on that. Mm. So the ability to see the opportunities and then actually take them. To put the hard work in, to be resilient, to keep bouncing back after multiple no's. I think it's probably a combination of both.
Were you a straight A student growing up?
No. No, I have far too much of a love for life to be purely an academic.
Yes, and for listeners to be aware, Sam has hobbled in on crutches today because she... had an injury surfing, so I'm very grateful for her to hobble through the pain and come into the studio and talk to us here. So you seem to have done a very good CEO answer on that. I asked you which was the most important, talent, hard work and luck, and you answered all of them. So you dodged the question. Thank you very much. We're coming to the close now. If anyone wants to get in contact, find out more about Uplift 360, where should they go and what should they do?
Definitely... come to our website, come to our LinkedIn page. We have a very open company. If you reach out to us online through our website or on our LinkedIn pages, someone will get back to you. We love engaging with people on what we're doing.
I think I saw you're hiring as well.
We are on a mass hire at the moment. We are looking to bring in chemists, chemical engineers, operations teams, business development. We are definitely interested in anyone within those skill set fields who would like to work in either Bristol or Luxembourg.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming in and thank you to the listeners.